Hi, welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that supports people with cancer in finding out about and utilising integrative medicine techniques to help them regain their health and well-being. My guest on the show today is an author who broke into the field of cancer and cancer research with his book Tripping Over the Truth, a sort of science detective story looking into the mechanisms of cancer, our understanding of them, and the consequences, in terms of the way that cancer is treated, that result from the established theories surrounding the disease. Travis Christofferson has just published his third book, so I'm keen to find out more. I'm talking to Travis over the internet in the United States. Hi Travis, welcome to the Yes to Life show.
Hi Robin, it's great to be here.
Okay, so it's a couple of years since you were last on, and you've certainly been very busy since then. We've got a lot to talk about. First, a little history. We were thrilled that you came to the UK to speak at our annual conference way back in 2016, would you believe? Tripping Over the Truth was pretty hot off the press then. And at that event, we also featured, amongst others, Paul Davies, principal investigator at the Centre for the Convergence of Physical Science and Cancer Biology, Arizona State University. Dr. Matsubuko from the Care Oncology Clinic, and making her very first public appearance talking about repurposed drugs, Jane McClelland. So could you just tell us your experience of that trip to the UK from the American view and what was to come out of it?
That's a great question. Yeah, there was a lot that spun out of that. Number one, you know, I after Jane gave her talk, I just remember how emotional it was, and you could just see this sort of rock star in the making. and then I don't believe her, I think her book came out 16, maybe a year later.
Yeah, at least.
And, you know, it's taken off, and she's really kind of started the revolution, which she said to me early on. I go, what do you want out of this? She said, to start the revolution. So she definitely achieved her goal, but you could see, you know, just the charisma, the genuineness, the patient advocacy, mm-hmm. and how broken oncology is, and how, you know, she could bring something new to the table. So that was one of the amazing things to me, to watch that take off. The other thing that was interesting was I met Dr. Matsubuko for the first time. Mm. You know, I had known a little bit about care, not a lot, but we kept a dialogue. And I had always been interested, you know, in a former life, I was a businessman and ran a business. And so I was struck by their model, how beautiful it was. And so when I came back, we kept up our dialogue, and I eventually started the U.S. version of Care Oncology with a partner. And since that time, 2016-17, it's grown to recover the entire United States through a telehealth network. The amount of patients we're seeing daily has grown just, you know, beyond our wildest expectations. So that was amazing. That was another thing that spun out of there. Another thing, you know, that was very interesting to me was meeting people in the crowd. And I met Dr. Slocum from Turkey, who was putting together combinations of all these metabolic therapies that we were sort of talking about. And so it was wonderful to go beyond this sort of theoretical thing that we started with, to having this clinician that's putting this all together in practice and publishing his results. And the last thing was Dr. Davies. You know, I hadn't looked into his career until after your wonderful conference, and his career was absolutely fascinating to have that high level of an astrophysicist turn to cancer the way he did. And the story is remarkable. It was the director of the National Cancer Institute, Anna Barker, was really frustrated by the lack of clinical progress around the world, especially in the United States, where the death rates really have not moved a whole lot. I think everybody kind of knows that by now. So she decided the best approach, she's this kind of disruptive thinker, the best approach was to approach this from a totally different angle. What are we missing? And so she instituted this physical science program at the National Cancer Institute, where they hired physicists to look at cancer from an entirely new lens. And Dr. Davies headed one of the centers there. And so he turned to cancer and looked at it through this, you know, fresh eyes of what the disease was. It was very interesting to me. He arrived at the same conclusion that I kind of arrived at in Tripping Over the Truth, that the somatic mutation theory was more or less absurd. It just, there is no way that theoretical explanation of cancer holds water, that it's a comprehensive explanation for what cancer is. And he came up with this model called the atavistic model that really overlaps with the metabolic theory of cancer. The cancer is kind of this sort of epigenetic disease that gets triggered by certain events. So yeah, Robin, I mean, it was an amazing conference, and it was one of those conferences where you go back and you just absorb everything for weeks and weeks, and it was amazing how many things spun out of that.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's very exciting for us to hear that, because, of course, it was a wild idea at the time to try and pull it together. And but I, you know, I've heard bits and pieces about, you know, what's happened as a result of these. It's just bringing the people together, really, isn't it? They're actually meeting people and exchanging ideas. It's so powerful.
That's it. Yeah, absolutely. And I feel bad, you know, this whatever this post-COVID, the COVID world we live in now, you know, we've shifted, unfortunately, we've shifted away from that. I used to kind of be jaded about conferences. You spend all this enormous amount of time and money and, you know, effort to go, but then you realize that intimate face-to-face meetings, you know, that's really where the interesting things come from.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, there's pluses and minuses to moving online. You're, of course, going to be featuring in our upcoming entirely online event. But, I mean, the plus on that side is that the lineup is just spectacular. You know, the 40-plus world experts we've managed to attract to it are absolutely stunning. And so the dialogue is going to be beyond.
I saw that, yeah. Bravo on the lineup. Very good. It's going to be exciting.
Yeah, so anyway, you'll be there as expert host interviewing Jane. So that's going to be fascinating in itself. I mean, I imagine you're going to rather enjoy that.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it a lot.
Yeah. Okay, so since that visit, you actually wrote another book, Curable. And in contrast to Tripping Over the Truth, which focused in on one specific mechanism underlying cancer and other chronic disorders, Curable seemed to be a much broader look at Western healthcare and its chronic condition. Do you want to say what you're trying to say in this second book?
Yeah, you know, Curable, you're right, it was a very 30,000-foot view at the healthcare system and why it's broken. Sort of the systemic reasons why you know, we spend, especially in the United States, where we spend about 20% of our GDP. So every $2 that exchanges out of 10 that exchanges hands goes towards healthcare.
Amazing.
Yet our outcomes are, you know, don't reflect that expenditure. They're not nearly, not even near the top. So what are we doing wrong? And that was kind of the dive into the overarching question that the book asked. And it really kind of falls into two buckets. What we're doing wrong is a ton of overtreatment, right? And the primary driver for that in the US is we have this fee-for-service system where doctors get paid for every procedure and test. So that automatically incentivizes them to do more.
Right.
And the statistics are dismal. When you look at it, you know, you can assess these different, so just look at the number of back surgeries per county in, say, like the state of Washington. It completely correlates with the number of surgeons within that county.
Right.
So it's not like they're being assessed about who absolutely needs this surgery. It's just doctors are very willing to cut when they necessarily don't have to. Mm. So that's systemic, and that's across the board. We treat way too much. And the second thing is we treat with these treatments that are insanely expensive for what you get out of them. And so what I look at is these very extremely undervalued treatments that we have right in front of us, you know, very obvious things like fasting, low carbohydrate, ketogenic diets, repurposed medications, things like that, that we just simply don't utilize. And we don't have the incentive structure to do that because there's no way for people to capture money from it. And it always comes down to money. So Curable, yeah, looked at the sort of those systemic problems, and you know, it really comes down to human psychology. What motivates people to do what they're doing, mm-hmm. why they do what they're doing. And most of the time, unfortunately, that circles back to money.
Mm. So that's the common factor between those two things that you've itemized there is, of course, the money. I would agree, it seems to be the thing that's wrong with healthcare. As a for-profit model, it basically is at odds with the aim of bringing about good health.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's, you know, within the book, I found some brilliant examples of people that are trying to fix it and doing a good job. And so how do you realign the incentive structure of a group of physicians? And so you look at primary care physicians because they're the front line. That's mm-hmm. where most of the cost savings are going to come from. And one model was they pay physicians a bolus amount of money per patient by the number of patients that they're estimated to treat per year.
Right.
And so the physicians are given this block of money at January 1st on, you know, the typical numbers they treat. And so the incentive structure all of a sudden switches for these doctors. It's like, okay, they get to keep all the money they don't spend, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if they spend less per patient, they keep that money. If they have better outcomes per patient, they keep that money. So now their whole goal is to keep their patients healthy and to not overspend on them. And they've had remarkable outcomes from that model. It just, you know, there's so much political inertia and money involved already that I'm not highly optimistic that something like that will kind of take over.
Hmm. Oh, well, okay. Well, do you think that healthcare was ready to hear your message to any degree?
Well, you know, I think that every time there's a presidential election, healthcare gets brought up.
Yeah.
And it just seems like we've been in this cycle where it gets brought up, nothing ever gets done. You know, we moved to Obamacare, which is not perfect, but it was a step sort of going in that direction. And you know, when I arrived at the conclusions in Curable, I'm not sure what the best fix is. When you look at what we have, this for-profit system versus what you guys have, the mm-hmm. NHS, a single payer system, you immediately wipe out about 15% of the cost, right, through fraud, through all the inefficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
But what you lose and what we have sort of going on in America now are these kind of entrepreneurial pockets of brilliance that you want to unleash that entrepreneurial spirit, these people that are really want to change it and are looking for solutions. And I feel like in a single payer system, everything kind of becomes homogenized and there's no more incentive to really make these really huge imaginary leaps to make it better. And one example is a company like Virta Health, which uses a ketogenic diet for type 2 diabetes.
Right.
And it's done online. It's an extremely efficient system. They have nutritionists track their patients' markers through technology. And the outcomes have been incredible. The patients have lost in the first year, the typical weight loss is 30 pounds. Inflammatory markers, lipid markers drastically improve. They remove about 63% of their diabetes medications, about 93% reduction in insulin use. And this is just done through diet.
Mm.
And so, and they can demonstrate the massive amount of savings to the system by doing it this way. Another example is something called, I think it was a hospital chain in Pennsylvania instituted this thing called the Fresh Food Pharmacy. And what it was is they just had, it was just a grocery store with fresh food, you know, not cheap carbohydrate food, just fresh produce and meats and things like that. And they kind of focused this pilot program on low-income people. And they gave them just access to this grocery store, I think twice a day or three times a week, something like that. And again, dramatic improvements. The cost savings were absolutely phenomenal because a lot of the food was donated by food banks, and they found ways to get the food cheaper. And I think the first year that it was like the savings was something like $40,000 per type 2 diabetic patient. So it's just an enormous amount of money and these very creative ways of doing things. And I would hate to lose that, you know, but I don't know how you capture both. I don't know if there's a way to capture that kind of innovative spirit of a for-profit system that really is trying to do it for-profit by saving money, right? So we think of disruptive technologies that do things better versus just a homogenous single-payer system. And I, you know, I really don't know the answer, Robin. Maybe you do.
No, I don't know the answer. I completely agree with you about the different set of problems experienced on each side of the Atlantic. The only thing I'll say is that to imagine that in Britain it's not for profit is to make a mistake, because fundamentally it is still for profit, and the single payer system is well enrolled in the profit model. But nonetheless, you're exactly right that the same incentive is not there, hence the lack of progress, the complete frustration with trying to push forward the agenda for integration is just like it's a massive obstacle, and America is way ahead on that because of the entrepreneurial model that you're describing.
Interesting.
Okay, I want to get on to the main topic for today. You've written another book, so this time you're heading back into the territory of Tripping Over the Truth. Do you want to tell us its title and what the overall thrust of the book is?
So this one came out of the lockdown. I was at the Metabolic Health Summit last February, and right after the summit, a man named Dr. Richard Veach died about 2 weeks after it. And his family allowed me to write a short sort of obituary or in memorial for him, which was posted on Medium. And that just got me interested in his life and his life's work, because it's truly a remarkable story. And the title of the book is called, it's called Ketones, the Fourth Fuel. It's on Amazon. It's a look really at the sweeping history of bioenergetics, which is humanity's quest to really map out how a living organism, how our bodies create energy and what that has meant. And where that led, that sort of historical sweep, went from these brilliant scientists, from number one, from Otto Warburg, this brilliant German scientist who was in Tripping Over the Truth. He was a cancer scientist as well. But really, his focus was energy metabolism. And then that his star student was Hans Krebs, who mapped out this central intermediate metabolic cycle that we've all heard of, the Krebs cycle. And his star student was Richard Veach at Oxford. And Richard Veach then went on this, again, this sweep, this continuum of trying to understand how energy is generated. He went on to sort of elucidate this auxiliary metabolism that we all have hidden within us called ketone metabolism or ketosis. It gets turned on during bouts of deprivation when someone's fasting or eating a very low carbohydrate, higher fat diet. And it was really maligned throughout most of the 20th century. Ketosis was looked at as this pathological condition.
Yes.
And I even dusted out my biochemistry book from 1995. And there was a paragraph on ketosis that said it was a dangerous metabolic state that somebody entered into when they were not eating or eating a low-calorie diet. And it had to be monitored, which I thought was so funny because you know, therapeutic fasting was sort of the in vogue treatment for obesity in the 50s and 60s. And people knew, doctors knew that this was perfectly safe. But somehow this just, you know, this gets lost in translation. And of course, that was the fat is bad era, you know, that was dominating the sort of the food pyramid at the time. So it was a very confusing message about this metabolic state of ketosis. But in the 20th century, nobody was studying it. It was looked at this terrible state. Nobody really understood what it was. And then Richard Veach, when he turned to it in the late 90s, really mapped out what it was. And it was this extraordinary fourth fuel that our bodies produce when we're basically fasting or not, you know, in a state of deprivation. And it had these remarkable properties. And Veatch uncovered these remarkable properties. It's a superior fuel. It burns with more thermodynamic energy. And that results in this sweeping change of all the metabolic hubs. So the thousands of reactions that comprise human metabolism are all driven to further completion. And Veatch realized right away that this had incredibly far-reaching therapeutic implications, which, you know, today scientists are still mapping out. It seems like every month there's a new publication on how ketones or the new exogenous ketones or a ketogenic diet affects some sort of new disease state. In fact, a month ago there was a paper about a ketogenic diet, an influenza virus, mm-hmm. where mice put on a ketogenic diet had dramatically reduced rates of death due to these changes in immune function from a ketogenic diet. So, again, this sweeps back to what we were talking about, Curicle, about one of the main problems we have across the globe now. It's not just Western cultures, it's Middle Eastern cultures, it's China, it's everywhere. It is this problem with type 2 diabetes and pre-diabetes of insulin insensitivity, right? Insulin resistance. Mm-hmm. And this is a problem of too little activity and too much carbohydrates. And it's about, in America, it's about $250 billion a year in cost. And the amazing Wow. thing about ketone metabolism is it completely bypasses all the pathologies associated with insulin resistance. Mm. So that was the take-home message for me in the book, was I wanted people to really understand that there is this way to not go into that state of insulin resistance that most of us are going to go into. By the time we hit 40, most people are showing signs of insulin resistance. Mm. So yeah, that's kind of the, I hope that's a good synopsis.
Fantastic. So to sum up, you'd say that this discovery of the fourth fuel is an extremely important one for the overall state of our health.
Absolutely. It goes, you know, the main effect of ketones, and the main one is beta hydroxybutyrate, is within the brain. Mm. And when you go back to the history of it, they never, through most of the 20th century, scientists thought that the brain could only burn glucose.
Yeah.
And they knew that the rest of the body tissues could burn fatty acids, but fatty acids couldn't cross the blood-brain barrier. So it was always presumed that the only fuel that the brain could burn was glucose. And the brain does burn predominantly glucose when we're our typical, you know, state. 99% of the people in the Western culture are burning glucose in their brain. But they couldn't explain how a fasting human, a normal human, can go about 2 months. And so when you do the math, the thermodynamic math, if the brain cannot switch from glucose, a person should only be able to live about 18 days.
Right.
So George Cahill discovered in the 60s that the brain could indeed pivot to ketones, and once you're in this fasted state, the liver starts producing beta hydroxybutyrate, and then the brain would transition to beta hydroxybutyrate as its primary fuel source. About 2/3 of the energy was produced by this new fuel source, and now that would explain how a fasting human can go 2 months. An obese human can go, the longest fast ever was over a year.
I read not that. A single bite. I couldn't believe it. I read that. Incredible, eh?
Yeah. Yeah. So the brain takes about 20% of our energy at any given time. It's this huge metabolic sink. And what happens when we enter our 40s, we start to develop a little bit of insulin resistance. And what that means is the body cannot use glucose very well. The cellular machinery that processes glucose begins to break down. So the brain in particular, which relies most of the time on glucose, develops what we call this sort of energy gap. So its energy requirements and the energy it's getting is not matched up. It has a gap of, by the time a healthy 65-year-old, even what we call healthy, has a gap of about 15%. Somebody that's got pre-Alzheimer's, that gap is, you know, 20-25%, even in their 40s. So with ketone metabolism, when you bathe the brain in this new fuel, it fills that energy gap because it bypasses all this sort of breaking down machinery of glucose metabolism that requires insulin. And it enters the cell through a different channel, and it goes into metabolism downstream of the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, which requires insulin to work. So it's like a, you know, a clogged highway. All of a sudden you have this free lane that is it's able to access. And that is incredibly important for brain health as we age, as far as dementia, Alzheimer's, and just, you know, general just cognition, fatigue, depression, all of those things depend on energy metabolism. And this fourth fuel is able to sustain that as we age.
Amazing. So it's a great thing. And there's obviously a lot more to find out. But it does look like that we're at the beginning of something really important. So one of the things I love about your writing as a non-scientist myself is that you manage to write about science and about complex subject matter in a thoroughly accessible way. You bring to life the story of the science, the history, and above all, you're able to capture the thrill of discovery that drives the scientists forward. I wonder if you could introduce us to the three main characters of your story who all feature on the cover: Warburg, Krebs, and Veitch, you've already mentioned. You know, Warburg, many listeners will have some familiarity with. Krebs, they've probably heard the Krebs cycle, but don't necessarily know what it's all about. And Veitch, I think, as yet, few will be familiar with. So would you give us an introduction to them all?
Yeah. Otto Warburg, I think he was born in 1883. Again, brilliant German scientist. He was born into this sort of golden era of science where he was a member of the Max Planck Institute in Germany, in Berlin. And if you were a member of this institute, you were given sort of unprecedented access to resources and freedom. Albert Einstein was a member, and you know, they had to deem the mind worthy of being a member of this institute. Warburg was the youngest member ever accepted. And so he spent most of his career never having to worry about resources, teaching pressures, writing grants, any of that. It was a wonderful system, you know, to unleash these brilliant minds like that and unburden them with all the problems that scientists face today. Warburg had to actually ask for money one time, and he just scribbled it on a napkin and he got it. So it gives you kind of insight into the era he was born into. But as a consequence of that, you know, he had dramatic, just his lab was incredibly productive. He was nominated for the Nobel Prize for three separate achievements. He won one Nobel Prize. He should have won more, but then there was political reasons why he didn't. He really wanted to understand, again, why the human body produced energy. And at the time, you know, they just didn't have it. It was so hard. I mean, it's like a completely unknown puzzle. You don't even have a starting point to go from. They knew that iron was involved in bringing oxygen into hemoglobin, but they didn't know how cells were combusting material to make energy. So he mapped out the first step, which was he showed the site where combustion was happening in the cell. It was one of the what we call cytochromes, which is an iron-containing protein where oxygen was pulled to within the cell, and then substrates from food were combusted to release energy. So that, you know, he really put this, you know, planted the ice spike on the ice wall and grabbed a foothold so everybody else could start mapping out this metabolic map. Hans Krebs entered his lab as a favor to a friend that Warburg had known, and he took a chance. Warburg took a chance on Krebs. Krebs was actually a medical doctor that had just showed this really, you know, intense interest in research, but didn't have a lot of experience. So Warburg actually trained Krebs on his own and set him free. And then Krebs proved himself to be this brilliant research scientist. And Krebs actually helped Warburg with that experiment I just described, which won the Nobel Prize. And described exactly where combustion was occurring in the cell, where respiration was occurring. And then he was only supposed to be there a year, but he ended up staying 4 years. And then there grew to be some sort of internal tension. Warburg was an extreme, sort of ran his laboratory with this authoritarian manner.
Right.
And Krebs began sort of asking questions and kind of showing the signs of, you know, being his own investigator. And Warburg didn't like that. So he told him it was time to leave after 4 years. And Krebs had this kind of deep internal tension between his father didn't treat him well. He had sort of a rough childhood. He needed sort of a mentor and craved that. And he was scared to kind of jump out on his own and be his own scientist. But he did. He went to Freiburg and got his own lab. And then he exploded and began doing, he discovered the urea cycle, which was a huge problem in biochemistry, how proteins are processed. And, you know, that put him on the map as one of the top biochemists in the world. He then had to flee Germany because of World War II, and he landed in the UK, eventually ended up at Oxford. When he first landed at Cambridge, and that's where he did his work that mapped out the elucidated the Krebs cycle, which again is one of these central sort of intermediate cycles where food substrates come in and they're processed through this cycle, which spins off other substrates, which then feed the electron transport chain, which then ultimately end with the reaction with oxygen and Warburg cytochrome. So he kind of filled in, you know, the main chunk of the metabolic map of how humans produce energy. Mm. He won the Nobel Prize in 1953 for that. But when he was at Oxford, he really wasn't into teaching students, and only the most distinguished U.S. professors taking sabbaticals were allowed in his laboratory. But he had a friend in the U.S. that he'd worked with in Freiburg, and Richard Veitch was, again, he was a medical doctor from Harvard. He had just graduated. He was kind of lost, like Krebs was, but he had an intense interest in research. So this friend of Veitch's called up Hans Krebs, he worked with him in Freiburg, and asked him if Veitch could enter his lab, and he said yes. So all three of them, you know, it was just fortuitous luck that they ended up being mentored by each other.
Yes.
So Veitch flew to Oxford and entered Krebs' labs, and again, he took off and showed this brilliant capacity to do bench research and discovered these incredible sort of the way metabolism works by these central, what we call coenzyme nucleotide couples. And what those are, like ATP, for example, is one of the main ones. And they're these central hubs of energy where all the food we eat and the air we breathe charge these, what they're, you can think of them like little batteries. ATP is like a little battery that then diffuses throughout the cell and powers thousands of reactions that comprise human metabolism. And what Veitch showed is there were four of these central nucleotide coenzymes that power metabolism, and that they were all interlaced with each other. So if one of them suffered, they all suffered. And the take-home message from this is if there was a way to supercharge these coenzyme couples, you could affect the entirety of human metabolism. Mm. And at that time, there was no known way to do it. And it was known that insulin resistance diminished these nucleotide coenzymes and caused all the reactions in metabolism to suffer. And that's when that work, then he stumbled onto ketone metabolism later on, about 10 years later. That was a way to charge up all these central hubs of metabolism and bring them back to the level of sort of health. There was this remarkable continuum to all their careers, which led to this kind of remarkable discovery of ketone metabolism.
And it's interesting, isn't it? It's this kind of central thread which you built your story around. Fascinating how they're kind of handing on the baton, so to speak, and each picking up and going forward. So one of the things that first became apparent to me on meeting Paul Davies is the way that the siloing of scientific disciplines, that's biology, chemistry, physics, etc., tends towards narrow thinking and even blind alleys. The truly great thinkers who've moved science forward, they've often demonstrated the ability to straddle disciplines or to apply the thinking of one discipline to another, much as Paul Davies himself has. So I'm just interested in the three protagonists of your story. How did they operate in this respect?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the central stories also, those were the three main characters. There was one other character named Peter Mitchell, who was a scientist in Cambridge. And at the time, when Mitchell was doing his work, the first part of energy metabolism was mapped out, what we call the glycolytic pathway. That's how carbohydrates enter the cell and are burned through 10 steps to generate pyruvate. pyruvate then enters the Krebs cycle and generates these intermediate sort of electron carriers, which then feed into the electron transport chain. It was not known how the electron transport chain operated. It was only presumed that it could operate through what we call substrate-level phosphorylation, and that means ATP is generated by traditional enzyme chemistry. You bring mm-hmm. together a phosphate group, ADP, and an enzyme. They all come together in space and time, and that generates ATP. So the entire field just sort of hypnotically was looking for this intermediate, and they couldn't find it. And Peter Mitchell, I mean, a decade passed, and it was the field was just broken. It was in a state of crisis.
Right.
And Peter Mitchell came along and just imagined a new way. He imagined this electron transport chain that would pump protons into this inner membrane space in the mitochondria, which is like an air compressor filling up with air. Then you have this potential energy of these protons in this fixed space. Then he imagined that the protons could flow back through, just like a pneumatic tool, flow through these enzymes called ATPase that then generate ATP. He had not a shred of experimental evidence to suggest this was true.
Right.
But over the decades, they finally, you know, enough evidence accrued that he had been absolutely right. And what you notice about those things is every single person was dogmatically stuck in this idea of the way it had to be.
Right.
Peter Mitchell was the first one that just imagined the new way, right? And you look at all the great scientists. You look at Einstein, who was ridiculed for general relativity. Mm. You look at, to me, Paul Davies and Tom Seyfried, who have imagined cancer in a new way, mm. far outside the extraordinarily dogmatic, entrenched belief system in the somatic mutation theory. Robin, that's one of the most fascinating things of science is how do these guys do that? What is this creative process?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not getting caught up in dogmatic thinking and its imagination, and it's wasting time. It's allowing yourself to just, you know, think and not encumbered by other problems, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Einstein was famous for that, for just walking in the woods and imagining things. So to me, that's one of the most interesting parts of science. You know, a lot of Krebs' work was really just straightforward chemistry, but he was the first to imagine the Krebs cycle in a cycle. All the other scientists were stuck in this idea it had to be a linear series of reactions.
Right.
So, yeah, the great leaps forward are just these momentary glimpses of things in a new way. Mm. Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? It's a completely different thing of work, which is closer to inspiration and, yeah, imagination, as you say, and not at all necessarily to do with structured thinking or any of the normal things you associate with science and research.
Right, right. Mm. And Peter Mitchell, you know, he was sloppy. You know, he didn't do his controls right. He was not a great experimentalist, but he had this gift of a wandering mind, and he was the one that solved the problem.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah. Okay, well, we were referring to this kind of handing on, this relay race, you know, of science and research. And overall, the understandings and discoveries of one generation getting handed on, along, of course, with all the inconsistencies, the erroneous thinking, and the outright dogma. But it seems the process of science often is less to do with an interest in forging a path into the unknown than in defending the known. And this, of course, can lead to massive decades-long detours or unnecessary roadblocks to progress. Your story certainly seems to feature some of these. Can you tell us some of the most shocking examples?
Yeah, I would, you know, to me, the most poignant example right now of that is cancer biology. Mm. And I still to this day cannot understand why the most prominent scientists have not just stood up and said the somatic theory is wrong.
Right.
And I can't, you know, I think what happens, Robin, is you get careers invested in a theory. Mm-hmm. You know, when someone's published dozens of papers on a theory, they don't want to go back and say, look, I was wrong about that. So I think the revision process is a very slow process where they inch into it, you know, in a certain way. And also it's the money. You know, when you have millions of dollars dedicated to DNA sequencing machines, you're probably going to keep sequencing genomes of cancer cells, even though you've learned all you're going to learn, because there's just too much inertia and money and grant writing involved in that. So, it's a horribly frustrating process to watch. And that to me, that's the one that's playing out in real time. I have no idea 100 years from now what they'll say about this period of time in cancer biology, but it seems to me like there is, like you said, way more invested in defending this broken paradigm, not only the theoretical basis of what cancer is, but also spinning into clinical work, you know, in the development of new drugs and how we do that is based on this flawed paradigm. So, it's money, it's investment in people and their egos. And then you have at the outside these sort of scientists that are chipping away at the dogma and suggesting new theories and questioning the evidence and so forth. And, you know, just in the short amount of time, it doesn't happen quickly, but since 2014, when I wrote Tripping Over the Truth, right, it has changed a lot. There has been a lot of much more acceptance of metabolism, of epigenetic changes, and sort of chipping away at the idea that the somatic mutation theory is a comprehensive explanation of what cancer is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's heartening. And in the world of medicine, 6 years is but a blink of an eye.
Right. That's true. Yeah.
Okay, so just to end up, because we're just about out of time, what are your hopes for your book and for the progress of healthcare?
Oh, well, you know, I guess the main hope of my book would be the take-home message that the way we age and the way we don't have to age, we don't have to go into this state of insulin resistance and diminished metabolic capacity. There is an alternative metabolism that we all have within us that offers a solution to that. And that alone, you know, could change healthcare by itself, because one of the most pernicious problems is pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes. In the U.S., it's over 50% of adults are either pre-diabetic or diabetic. So that we have this extraordinarily cheap solution to that right in front of all of us. It just takes willpower and education. Healthcare, you know, I again, it's one of those problems of massive institution and the need for institutional change. But we just keep doing our part, you know, like I just keep trying to write these books and take this message. And Jane has done a tremendous job advocating for cancer patients and showing that there are cheap, safe, other things that people can do. Care Oncology is an innovator in that space. Virta Health, there's a lot of pockets of really good things. And I think, you know, it catches on when people, with social media, messages spread so much faster that it seems like you see these messages being passed around much more. So I'm optimistic. I think that change is happening. And we just keep all doing our part. You're doing your part and should be applauded for that as well.
Thanks. Yeah, I think you're right. We've all got to keep pushing any way we can. All right. So thanks very much for joining us today, Jarvis. Totally fascinating material to delve into. And it's so important to understanding our own health and well-being.
Yeah, fun. It was fun. Great questions. Thanks, Robin. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Ketones, the Fourth Fuel is available now in paperback and e-reader editions, and as you heard in the interview, Travis is featured in this autumn's Yes to Life online event, Your Life and Cancer 2020, in which he'll be interviewing Jane McClelland, author of How to Starve Cancer. For full details and for booking, go to yourlifeandcancer.com. Thanks for listening today. Do join me again next week for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.